I was thinking today and I realized that I believe this is correct, that the few times that I've had the honor to teach the lesson here has always been, well, at least three out of the four, or maybe four out of four, has always been on the Sunday night before Christmas. I just look like Santa Claus, but there's a guy in the audience that looks more like Santa Claus than me, but we'll leave that for another day. Also, too, this morning, I looked over to the area over there. Now, tonight, y'all kind of covered up the area. And I told Elaine, I said, look over there. There's a black hole where all those college kids were sitting. She says, no, it's a maroon hole. So they just sucked them off. So you guys are sitting in that area. You need to be careful. There's no telling where you might end up. About 2 years ago, I think it was, on the guy's class studied Daniel. Daniel was studied because of the election coming up. And the point of Daniel that we studied it from was the fact that God is in control. We thought at that time that we were in control because we get to vote. But really, that's not true. God was really in control, and He's in control of everything and all the time. So I decided after that time, I started looking to try to see more examples of where God is in control. And you would really be surprised if you read the book. God's in control almost on every single event that happens. So I looked at the fact, I always thought there was one trial of Jesus. And that's not true. There's actually six individual trials of Jesus. And so this lesson could be six individual lessons. And, what is it, Acts 27, he preached until midnight, so I don't think you should gripe if I decided to preach until midnight. So there's actual, precedent set by Paul. But I don't think I'll do that. What I tried to do was shorten this thing down into one lesson. And it's called The Six Trials of Jesus. We started off, and the reason I got this was because Jesus is in control of His own destiny. Many times we believe or think that the devil or the Jews or Pilate or Romans or somebody were in control, but that is not correct. God was in control of what was going to happen to Jesus, and Jesus knew it. That's one of the reasons we read John 8:52 through 59. Oh, by the way, this is an old-timey lesson, which means you either have to have a Bible, or you have to have your phone, or you have to have your iPad, so you can turn to the books. I expect to hear pages clipping all the time. That's when we were much younger, some of us old ones, before all these fancy computers. That's what you heard all night long, was the pages being turned. So I expect you to turn the pages to these verses. So John 8:52 through 59, which was read earlier, was the fact that Jesus is going to be killed. I don't understand how He did this. But the last part of it says, they took up stones to cast at to Him. But Jesus hid Himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. What that tells me is Jesus was in control. He knew that He was not supposed to be stoned on that day. Now, how He did this, was it a miracle? I don't really know. It doesn't really tell us that. But the fact is that Jesus understood that he was going to be crucified and not stoned by these guys at the temple. Look at Luke 9:51. Luke 9:51. It says, "And it came to pass when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to Jerusalem." He knew the time was come for him to go to Jerusalem. Mark 10:32 through 34 says, "And they were in the way going to Jerusalem, and Jesus went before them, and they were amazed, and as they followed, they were afraid. And he took again the 12 and began to tell them what things should happen unto him, saying, Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be delivered unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles, and they shall mock him, and shall scourge him, and shall spit upon him, and shall kill him, and the third day he shall rise again." Jesus knows the exact time that he's going to be crucified. He knows the exact method that was going to happen. He knows that he's going to be condemned by the Jews, and that he knows that they're going to take him and put him before the Gentiles, and the Gentiles are going to mock him, Herod, and he knows that he's going to be scourged, and he knows that he's going to be spit upon, and he knows he's going to be put to death. So, no Jew, no Roman, no person or group of people were in control. God was in control, and Jesus knew what was going to happen. So as I said, this is about the trials. And there are actually 6 trials, 3 of them by the Jews and 3 of them by the Romans. So that the major people that are, that's why we read Luke 3:1-2. The major characters that exist in this time were mentioned in Luke 3:1-2. You had Pontius Pilate, Herod, Annas, and Caiaphas. They are all mentioned in that verse. That's why they are in power. They think they are. But Jesus knows who's in power. So the first trial, which is not very much talked about, but it's mentioned, is to Annas. He's mentioned by Josephus in his works. This guy was one of the chief movers of the death of Jesus. He lived into his 90s and was described as venomous and as a zealous bigot. He was deformed in mind and body. You say, well, the body, his hands were all gnarled up. So he wore silk gloves so that people couldn't see this. His mind was vicious in the fact that he decided that if you were one of his enemies, he's kind of like Stalin. If you were one of his enemies, we'll just kill you and get rid of you. This was going on until Tiberius in the 15 AD said, that's the end of this stuff. He took him out of power and set somebody else up to be the power. But the problem was that Annas, all of the chief priests that follow are either his sons or his son-in-laws. So the power behind it, behind the office of chief priest, is Annas. And he remained in power for roughly 50 years, all the way until the destruction of Jerusalem. So if you'll turn to John 18, we'll be there a little bit. John 18, and we'll look at verses 12 and 13. John 18, 12 and 13. Then the band and the captain and the officers of the Jews took Jesus, bound him, and led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. So when they first take Jesus, what do? They take him to the guy that they understand is the real power. So his first trial, Jesus is before Annas. Now there's not a lot written about it, and it's kind of difficult to understand which is what. But if you look at John, keep right there, 18, we'll start in verse 15. And Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. That disciple was known unto the high priest and went in with Jesus into the palace of the high priest. But Peter stood at the door without, and then without that other disciple, which was known unto the high priest, spake unto her that kept the door and brought in Peter. Then saith the damsel that kept the door, art not thou also one of this man's disciples? He said, I am not. And the servants and the officers stood there, who had made a fire of coals, for it was cold, and they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. Jesus answered him, I spake openly to the world, I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple, whether the Jews resort, always restore, and in secret have I said nothing. Why answerest thou me? Ask them which heard me, one, what I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I said. And when he had thus spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, answerest thou the high priest? So Jesus answered him, if I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil, but it is well. Why smitest thou me? Now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas, the high priest. So that may be what's going on with Annas at that point in time. He could be in front of Annas, who they would call the high priest, because remember, high priest live, or high priest until they die. So the Jews would think of him as that. He is the power behind the power. But he takes him and sends him over to Caiaphas. Well, the court of the high priest, what is that? That was actually a big palace area. And in the palace, there's an imposing structure with apartments and courtyards and stall for guards and the usual items of a palace. It's likely that both Annas and Caiaphas lived in the same place. They were just so, in other words, if they was going to send him over to Caiaphas' home, all he had to do was send him across the courtyard over to the other apartment over there where he was living. So we go to the second trial. The second trial is before Caiaphas. Caiaphas. He was the son-in-law of Annas by marriage to his daughter and ruled longer than any high priest in the New Testament time. He was a Jewish leader of the time. There were serious concerns during his time of the Roman rule and the insurgent zealous movement that wanted to eject the Romans. So he had to kind of walk a fine line. He didn't want the Romans, but he didn't want them kicked out either, because if they get kicked out, then the Romans are going to come in and wipe him out. So the Romans would not perform an execution over a violation of a Jewish law, but they would over their own laws. Therefore, the charge of blasphemy meant nothing in front of Pilate. That might mean something to a Jew, but that don't mean nothing to a Roman. So he had to establish, at this trial, he's going to try to establish that there are two verdicts to put Jesus to death. First was blasphemy. then the Jews would put him to death or would feel like it's needed. The second one was the Messiah or the Christ or the kingship movement, which is the zealous movement. Then the Romans are going to put him to death. So Capias is going to try to fish on a fishing expedition and try to understand who is, try to get Jesus to admit these two things. And if he can do that, then he's home free. So in John, remember also, this is the same guy in John 11, 49 through 52. I don't hear no pages. John 11, 49 through 52 says, "And one of them, named Capias, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, You know nothing, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not. And this he spake not to himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for that nation, and not for the nation only, but that also he should gather together in one children the God that was scattered abroad." So God uses an enemy of his people to prophesy. So that tells me that God is in control over this man. God is going to be the one that allows and predicts and makes the happenings occur. Not the people and not the devil. God's in control. So we go back to the second trial in Matthew 26, 57. "And they laid hold on Jesus and led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled." Well, I know you guys think I only believe in the King James, but I do read other versions, I will admit that. And if you look at the American Standard Version here, it'll state, "And they had taken Jesus and led him away to the house of Capias." So this is that courtyard routine. He came from this side of the courtyard over to this side, because they both lived in the same palace. So now you go to Luke 22, 62 through 65. So we're still in the second trial. "Peter went out and wept bitterly, and the men that held Jesus mocked him and smote him, and when they had blindfolded him, they struck him on the face and asked him, Prophesy, who is it that smote thee? And many other things blaspheming spake they against him." And then Matthew 26, 59 through 62, "And now the chief priests and the elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. And at last came two false witnesses, and this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. And the high priest rose and said unto him, Answer thou nothing? What is it that these witnesses said?" So he has been fishing, trying to get Jesus to admit a guilt. He ain't got any. So they basically bring in the Sanhedrin. Now the fact is that the Sanhedrin can't really meet until its day. That's just part of the rules. They want to make a formal prosecution against before the whole Sanhedrin. Now, the trial had begun when they started asking Jesus questions. They bring in everybody. They spend the night running around from house to house to get them, because what I understand, and I could be wrong, I think there's like 70 people in this group. So it's not like you just go down the street and get George and come on in. There's 70 of them that are in this Sanhedrin. And so Jesus is still in control. So then the climax of the trial, the third trial of the Jews, is when Jesus basically admits something to them and they didn't even know it was coming. Look at Luke 22, verse 66. As soon as it was day, now they got them all together. The elders of the people, the chief priests, the scribes came together. That's the Sanhedrin. And led him into their council, saying, "Art thou the Christ?" Now the reason that's important now, remember, what's the Christ? He is the Messiah. He is the new king over Jerusalem and over Israel. "Art thou the Christ? Tell us." He said unto them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I also ask you, you will not answer me, nor let me go. Hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of power of God." Then they said, "Art thou the Son of God?" And he said unto them, "Ye say that I am." And they said, "What need we of any further witness?" So what they have here is they have established, Jesus with his own words has established that he's going to sit on the right hand of God. He is the Messiah. He is the Christ. He is the new king, Romans king. At the same time, he says, "You say that I am the Son of God." That's blasphemy. So I got the Jewish law broken. So I am ready now for Pilate, because I have him where I want him. Except he doesn't. Jesus is the one that gave him the information. Jesus is the one that's in control, not these Sanhedrins. And it is interesting, what I did find out was that that number one, there can never be a night trial. So therefore, that's why they had to wait for day. Number two, they could never pronounce death on a man except after 3 days. And they're going to pronounce death that night, that day. So the Sanhedrin is breaking their own laws and their own rules constantly in this trial that they have. So we go to the fourth trial. Now, in the fourth trial, it's a very short trial. In Matthew 27, 1 and 2. Matthew 27, 1 and 2. "When the morning was come, and all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. And when they had bound him, they led him away and delivered him to Pontius Pilate." So he goes before Pilate. The first thing right out of the box, Pilate tries to get rid of this problem. Look at Luke 23, 4, 7. Luke 23, 4, 7. "Then said Pilate to the chief priests and to the people, 'I find no fault in this man.' And they were more fierce, saying, 'He stirred up the people, teaching throughout all the land, beginning from Galilee to this place.'" Pilate perks up. "When Pilate heard that he was from Galilee, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. And as soon as he knew he belonged unto Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who himself also was at Jerusalem at that time." So number one, this guy, I got no fault with him. What do you got this guy here before me? Oh, he's a Galilean. I'm going to send him over to Herod. That way I don't have to worry about this problem anymore. So you get to the fifth trial. You get Luke 23, 8 through 12. The fifth trial is before Herod. "And when Herod saw him, he was exceedingly glad, for he was desirous to see him for a long season, because he had heard many things of him, and he hoped to have seen some miracles done by him. when he questioned with him in many words, as he asked him nothing, and he answered him nothing. And the chief priests and the scribes stood and vehemently accused him. And Herod, with his men of war, set him at naught, mocked him. Remember the prophecy of mocking? Mocked him, and arrayed him in a glorious robe, and sent him again to Pilate. And the same day, Pilate and Herod were made friends together, for before there had been enmity between the two. So he goes before Pilate. So what happens? Pilate can't get anything out of him. There's nothing here. So what does he do? He just mocks him, sends him back. So we come to the sixth and the last trial. But Pilate ain't through. Pilate has ambitions of getting rid of this problem. He doesn't want any part of it. So we get to the second effort to release Jesus under Pilate. Excuse me. Luke 23:13-15. Luke 23:13-15. Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people, said unto them, "You brought this man unto me as one that perverteth the people. And behold, having examined him before you, have found no fault in this man touching these things. Wherefore you accused him? No, nor yet Herod. I sent you to him, and lo, nothing worthy of death is done unto him." So he's using another. I don't find no fault. Herod don't find no fault. Why don't we let this guy go? We all know that ain't going to happen. So we come to the third effort of Pilate to let the guy go. Look at Luke 23:16. "I will therefore chastise him and release him." Now, chastising him sounds simple to us. But chastise to him means that he's going to get scourged. He's going to scourge him, and many of the guys died. So Pilate really, he actually has no moral scruples. He sends no fault for this guy. Herod doesn't have any fault with him, but I'll just beat him to death for you. And that ought to satisfy you. If he lives, the gods are for him. If he's not, no problem. So that's the third effort. But the people don't buy into this. The chief priests and the rulers. So we go to the fourth effort that Pilate tries to release him. It's in Mark 15:6-11. Mark 15:6-11. "Now at that feast he released unto them one prisoner whosoever they desired. And there was one named Barabbas, which lay bound with them that had made insurrection with them, who had committed murder in insurrection. And the multitude, crying aloud, began to desire him to do what he had done before. But Pilate answered them, saying, 'Will ye that I release unto you the king of the Jews?' For he knew that the chief priests had delivered him for envy. But the chief priests moved the people that rather they should release Barabbas unto them." So that don't work. So we go with the fifth effort. So John 19:7-12. John 19:7-12 is the fifth effort for Pilate to release him. The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." Now when Pilate therefore heard that saying, he was the more afraid, and went again to the judgment hall, and said unto Jesus, "Whence art thou?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Then said Pilate to him, "Speakest thou not unto me? Knowest thou not that I have the power to crucify thee, and have the power to release thee? Jesus answered, thou couldst have no power at all against me except it were given thee from above. Therefore he that delivered me unto thee hath a greater sin. And from thenceforth Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, if thou let this man go, thou art Caesar's friend. Whosoever maketh him a king speaketh against Caesar. So the Jews played their two trump cards. Their first trump card was, Jesus is the Son of God. This man says it. The second trump card is Jesus is a king. So they played all their cards on the table, as we would say. But you notice what Jesus told him? God is in control. Not the Jews, not you, not the devil, not anything. God is the one in control. So we come to the sixth effort by Pilate to let him go. He suggests, y'all just take him and do whatever you want to. It's in Matthew 27, 24 through 26. And when Pilate saw that he could prevail nothing, but rather a tumult was made, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, I am innocent of the blood of this just man. See ye to it. Then answered all the people and said, his blood be on us and on our children. Then he released Barabbas unto them, and when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. So we had six trials. Not one, but six different trials. To summarize Pilate's efforts to let him go, he first sent him to Herod. Next, he gave a verdict of innocent. Next, he offered a lighter punishment, even though I'm not sure scourging was, but I guess it is. He offered a lighter punishment. He proposed a choice between Jesus and this prisoner. He insisted on Jesus innocent. Why? What evil hath he done? He suggested they take him as a mob rule and do away with him because I am innocent and he should be released. And we look at Pilate and we kind of say, this guy really has no backbone. Well, as I thought about this, I thought of all of us that have no backbone. Do we send Jesus and not to others, but not for me? We say, yeah, Jesus is right for my mother and my dad. Jesus is right for my sister or my brother. Jesus is right for my husband or my wife. But he's not right for me. How many times have we heard that in our lives? Jesus is innocent, but he's not for me. In other words, how many times have we read, I've read it, Jesus is a wise man, but he's not really for me. I only want a little bit of Jesus' commands. I read his book, and I'll take this part. But I don't want this part. This part here is a little too hard. I don't really agree with it, so I'm only going to do this section of his word. In fact, I think Thomas Jefferson actually took his Bible and just, you know, cut out the parts he didn't like, so he just had what he wanted. So you got to understand, I don't want him all the time, all of his rules. Do we choose between Jesus and the world? We take Jesus on Sunday. I got no arguments. God will be here Sunday. Maybe Wednesday if I feel good. But I want the world for the other 5 or 6 days. Jesus is a good man, but he's not God. How many times have we read or heard that Jesus is like Muhammad, or Jesus is like Gandhi, or Jesus is like Buddha, or Jesus is like... He's a good man, but he's not God. Let others have Jesus. It's a good thing that the United States has, at one time, 80% or better Christians, and I don't know what the number is today, Christians, because they set everything right. The laws will be followed. They follow the rules. They don't break the rules. They do all that stuff. So he is good, and he's honest, and I want everybody to have him. But I don't need him. I don't mind living in the country where he rules, but I don't want him for me. Or we just want to get away from Jesus. I really don't want to think about him. I don't want to read what he says. I don't want to look at the book. I just want to wash my hands of him. So the question is, how many of us follow those problems just like Pilate? And if for any reason tonight you have fit one of those categories and you want to change that, this is the time that you would come forward and have the elders pray, or maybe even we have a baptism tonight, to follow Jesus and don't be like Pilate. As we come and we stand and we sing the song of encouragement.